Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
Obviously, not the outcome we wanted. We had our chances. Can't turn the ball over the last three series. I think our guys continue to fight. We got down 14. I think nobody on the sideline blinked. We were able to catch them again after halftime. I gotta solve that riddle after halftime. Obviously, it was the turnovers today. And again, I take responsibility for it all. Players got to get better. They know that. I got to coach them better. But at the same time, I think the guys are trying as hard as they can.
How do I characterize the results? They were poor. You got to give credit to Chicago. They did all the things that we really wanted to do in this ball game. They did it to us. They ran the ball better than we did. They didn't turn the ball over. You know, they made a lot of gritty, tough plays, and they wouldn't perform well. It was just penalties and miscommunication, and you know, there was something, you know, about every other drive that kind of stalled you. You were starting from back a little bit further than you'd like in certain situations, talking about putting yourself back with a holding penalty or false start or something. And we just were not sharp at all. I mean, there was no rhythm to it. You know, that's my fault. I got to get these guys in better rhythm, and we got to play better. We didn't play well.
The 41st edition of golf's premier team event, the Ryder Cup. The minds of fans at Hazeltine National Golf Club and the golf world at large were still fastened to the memory of a singular legend.
Arnold Palmer! Arnold Palmer!
The host Americans shot out of the gates on Friday morning. Led by youngsters Patrick Reed and Jordan Spieth, the morning foursomes were dominated by the U.S. team, who claimed their first opening session sweep since, coincidentally, Palmer was captain back in 1975.
It has been a remarkable opening session for the United States.
Europe dominated the afternoon, winning 3 of 4 matches. Just 5 points. That's all that separated the U.S. team from their first Ryder Cup win since 2008 at the start of play on Sunday. The U.S. team was not to be denied. Fowler, Snedeker, Brooks Koepka, all holding their nerve to win their matches, pushing the United States across the finish line. It was Ryan Moore finally doing the honors with the clinching point.
You know, friends, so many people have wished me congratulations on a 67-year career in baseball, and they wished me a wonderful retirement with my family. And now, all I can do is tell you what I wish for you. May God give you for every storm a rainbow, for every tear a smile, for every care a promise, and a blessing in each trial. For every problem life seemed a faithful friend to share, for every sigh a sweet song, and an answer for each prayer. You and I have been friends for a long time, but I know in my heart that I've always needed you more than you've ever needed me. And I'll miss our time together more than I can say. But you know what? There will be a new day and eventually a new year. And when the upcoming winter gives way to spring, oh, rest assured, once again, it will be time for Dodger baseball. So this is Vin Scully wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon wherever you may be.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
You know, it is rare that anything would pull me away from Monday afternoon quarterback right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket on a Monday. It is rare that I would include anything in our montage there or ask our producer, Mr. Cushlin, to include anything in the montage. not related to the greatest game the good Lord ever saw fit to create in his infinite wisdom, and that is the game of football. But I'll tell you what, a couple of events yesterday and a couple of events over the weekend really, really made that change today. Vin Scully called his final inning of baseball yesterday. You just heard his sign-off after 67 glorious years of his 88 on this planet thus far, spent entertaining the masses as the voice of America's national pastime, the great game of baseball. The Ryder Cup, the American team rising up above all challenges and rising up against all expectations to finally win the cup for a rare first time in 4 years, and I think only for like the third time in the last dozen chances, I think. Not years, but chances.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, the Europeans had dominated, but the Americans found a way to pull together and provided us with just a spine-tingling moment as the fans gathered there after the Americans won, spontaneously bursting into the national anthem. By the score, just an absolutely wonderful experience. We'll play part of that for you as we go. So we have that going on. The Cleveland Indians, not only did they clinch the American League Central Division Championship, as we know, now, by playing strong all the way through the weekend, they have found their way into the home field advantage for the divisional round against the Red Sox. The Red Sox lost yesterday, coupled with the Indians' win, gave the Indians a half-game advantage over the Sox. So they are indeed going to be hosting Game 1 on Thursday. And if necessary, they would host a Game 5, which is extraordinarily important, given the way they have played at home. And then, of course, the Detroit Tigers on the flip side, dropping 2 of 3 when they needed all three in Atlanta against the lowly last-place Braves, bringing to an end their playoff chances. Obviously, the American League wild card game will be played between the Orioles and the Toronto Blue Jays. The Tigers on the outside looking in, they pretty much collapsed down the stretch in the final week. They needed wins against teams that they should have beaten. They did not get them. And that's got fans all over Detroit asking, who goes first? Is it Brad Ausmus or is it Jim Caldwell? And with all of that having been said, now I can tell you it's time for Monday Afternoon Quarterback.
Grab your helmet. You're going in. It's time to play Monday Afternoon Quarterback on 106.5 The Ticket.
Monday Afternoon Quarterback we bring you each and every Monday for the obvious reason to celebrate the greatest game on earth. College football Saturday did not disappoint. That was an absolute thriller down in Clemson, where two top five teams went to battle. Number 3 Louisville, number 5 Clemson. Deshaun Watson outduels Lamar Jackson. Now they've got an inside track right back to the playoffs where they made it to the championship game last year. Louisville's going to need some help. Michigan and Wisconsin, 4-8, a top 10 matchup that was just a grueling defensive battle won by the Mason Blue, who remain 4-0, or I'm sorry, 5-0 now, 5-0, correction, with two Big Ten wins. So that was exciting. No game the entire weekend, however, was more exciting than the Toledo Rockets game against BYU, but it was on Friday night, so maybe not a lot of people aren't thinking about that. But what an unbelievably heartbreaking loss, the first loss of the season for the Toledo Rockets, 55-53. BYU hits a field goal at the buzzer to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. They were down 53-52 after a late Toledo score. But BYU holds on 55-53, an outstanding game. And just to round out the coverage of the locals, of course, Ohio State did as expected. They hammered on Rutgers 58-0. Very symmetrical in that game, by the way, because they scored 29 points per half. It was 29 in the first half, it's 29-0 at the half, and then 29 more in the second half makes that 58. 58-0 as expected. And the very, very disappointing season thus far for the Bowling Green Falcons continues as well. Mike Jinks, 1-4 now to start his BG career after a 28-25 loss to Eastern Michigan. So that's Saturday and Friday. And that didn't even get us to yesterday in the National Football League, where the Cleveland Browns became and remain the NFL's only winless football team. Kush, did you realize that?
Everybody else
has a dub except for the Browns.
Yes, I did realize that as I spent the second part of the afternoon, because you know the 1 o'clock, 4 o'clock block, how the NFL works. Yes, I spent the entire second block wondering, oh, are the Saints going to actually win this one and allow the Browns to be the only winless? Because that would make too much sense. And
sure enough.
That's exactly what happened. And so much there that you just went over, you know, to digest. And you know, I gotta say, at least for me, and I'm glad that I was able to end the montage with that one. You recommended I go find that.
Well, hold on. If you're going into a different direction, now let me finish the NFL
stuff. Please do.
All I mentioned was the Browns part, which of course they are now the NFL's only winless team.
Because of course.
Exactly right. Because that's just the way it's supposed to be. And then the Detroit Lions fell to the Chicago Bears, the awful Chicago Bears, if I dare say. Awful. They are. But they were at home, so it's a road loss. Two straight road losses. Three straight losses overall for the Lions now to fall to 1-3. The Pittsburgh Steelers, we stay in the AFC North, of course, just to cover the Steelers, Bengals, and Ravens, because that's always an interesting race. The Steelers hammered the Chiefs last night, 43-13, to move to 3-1, and really kind of give people a glimpse of what might be the best offense in the National Football League when everybody is healthy. Le'Veon Bell was dynamic last night on primetime. And the Cincinnati Bengals go back, of course, to Thursday. They beat the Dolphins. They are 2-2. They beat the Dolphins 22-7, just to kind of cover all the bases there. The Ravens, by the way, lost their first of the season. The Raiders took them down 28-27. So there's a tie atop the AFC Central or AFC North. There's an old blast. The AFC North with the Steelers and Ravens both at 3-1, and then in the NFC North. The Lions are tied for last with those 1-3 Bears, everybody chasing the 3-0 Vikings who go tonight. So there you have it, a little bit of an update on what happened on our football weekend, college style and professional style. Now, Jim Cushlin, if you want to go back into some of the only things that would take us away from a conversation on Monday afternoon quarterback, you wanted to go back to Vin.
Yeah, man, and that's partly because, you know, I viewed some of these games. I flipped around as I always do on a Saturday, Sunday. But I'm not going to lie, Bob. As a fan, my mind right now, you know, is on the various baseball things. With all the closings of careers yesterday highlighted by Vin Scully, I made sure to flip back over because I knew someone would carry that last inning in San Francisco that he got to broadcast. And then the Indians now, you know, in the playoffs, keeping an eye on the Tigers, seeing if they could actually pull it off. I feel like, you know, given that it's now October, I feel like I should ask forgiveness for still having baseball first on my particular plate. But
well, no,
to me,
I mean,
that's
the
just
playoffs
the,
are
it
here.
Is.
No, I mean, look, when the NBA went into the playoffs, which, of course, I think everybody agrees the NBA playoff season is far too long and far too stretched out. I mean, honestly, it goes through all of May and most of June. It does take too long. But when the playoffs come up, they become front and center for us, you know, in sports talk, even though it's baseball season.
Especially so, when we have a situation where both Cleveland and Detroit are in it, which should
playoffs.
Be a case
Bingo.
Next spring as well.
Absolutely right. So just because it happens to be football season now, guess what? Baseball's playoffs start. They do take, you know, precedence in depending on the mood and depending on what's going on and the fact that there is a local team involved. The Tigers are not in, but the Indians are. And so therefore, no, you are forgiven. You are exonerated for your baseball first leanings, even though it is Monday afternoon quarterback time. By the way, what's really going to freak you out? Do you realize that the NFL season is a quarter over? It's a quarter over. They're at the quarter pole right now. You know,
yeah, they are.
Yeah, well, I mean, the teams are 3-1. Everybody's played four games.
Right.
So, you know, you play four games of a 16-game schedule, you're a quarter done, which is hard to believe because it feels like the league just got launched, or the season just got launched, I should say, in the National Football League. But here we are. You know, four games are done. Tom Brady is coming back this week to play against the Browns. Josh Gordon would be coming back this week to play for the Browns if he hadn't decided to go into rehab, which, again, we'll go back into all of that again later. You know, which is probably spurred by, you know, another positive drug test or the another positive drug test to come that he knew he was going to fail.
Boy, I've been thinking that all weekend myself on that story.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And I know you were gone Friday when we talked about it a lot, but there's no question about it. This is not some epiphany where an eye-opening moment happened and I need to go get help. This is a crap. I'm about to get busted again. I have to take another urine test in 2 days, and I've been smoking weed. So I'm screwed. I just better go check in and get this thing over with. That's what I believe happened here. But anyway, we're a quarter past already. We're a quarter into this whole thing, which is amazing to me. When you think about it, I like to break the 16-game schedule down that way and kind of project out. And
but by the way, as interesting as that is, because, yeah, it's correct. I didn't even realize it myself. And then you mentioned it's like, yeah, everybody's played four games or a quarter in. Or if you want to spin it locally a negative way, there's still three quarters of this season left.
Well, you know, that's what I was about to say. I like to project everybody out at the quarter pole. And if you repeat yourself, you know, quarter by quarter, you know, you've got a winless Cleveland Browns team at 0-16. You would have a 4-12 projecting it out Detroit Lions team. You would have an undefeated Denver Broncos team. You would have a 12-4 Steelers, 12-4 Ravens, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, you get an idea. You know how we always talk about where teams are at the 40-game mark of a baseball season?
Sure.
You can't judge everything in the first month. And, you know, 40 games, you kind of get an idea that you are, you know, this is what you are. This isn't just a hot start if you streaked.
Right,
and
right.
This isn't just, they just got a slow start if they slumped. You know, that stuff can be overcome in 20 games, 25 games, 30 games, 40. Once you get to 40 in the baseball jargon, we kind of just say this is what you are. That's pretty much the measuring stick. And it's been pretty accurate most of the time. I do that with the quarter pole of the football season, too. You know, you lose one to start, you lose two in a row, man, your playoff hopes are already dimmed according to statistical and historical analysis. Your playoff hopes are really, really in trouble if you lose your first two. But you can still bounce back. And I'll give you an example. The Buffalo Bills are a bounce-back example. They have now won a couple in a row. They started out 0-2, but now they shut out the Patriots yesterday, and they've revived. They are a 500 team at the pole, the quarter pole. I think that's probably what they're going to be. You know, I think the Steelers are going to be every bit as good as their 3-1 indicates. I'm surprised the Ravens are. I think I'm a little surprised the Broncos are undefeated right now. Clearly, they're not going to go undefeated. But they are much better offensively than I thought they would be under Trevor Siemian. What else? The Vikings, I'm very surprised, given where they are at 3-0 with Sam Bradford, being the new quarterback, replacing Teddy Bridgewater, and with the injury to Adrian Peterson. I'm surprised they're 3-0. They've
got
the Giants
worded
tonight.
What's interesting is I worded it's on the Vikings. I worded this on Friday when I was making some picks while in for Mike on Drive Time. And the way I thought of it is, here's a team, you know, you lose Bridgewater. Now you lose Peterson. Clearly the rest of this roster was evidently built to do something big, because I'm kind of surprised they're 3-0 already.
I'm shocked.
Honestly.
I'm absolutely shocked. And the fact that they won the first one with Sean Hill and then the
right.
next two with Bradford, who probably only has about two-thirds of the playbook maybe memorized, the fact that they're 3-0 is really an incredible testament to Mike Zimmer's coaching and just, you know, the veterans on that team and everybody else who has stepped up to lead in the absence of their two playmakers on offense. So, anyway, it's a quarter of the season over, which is an amazing story. So we have a lot of ground to cover here already. Like I said, the college game, the NFL games, the Ryder Cup in golf, and, yes, baseball's playoffs ready to go. Are you surprised? I got to admit I am. I thought the Indians were going to be going to Fenway for game one, Jim Kushner.
I did kind of too. And not only that, there was a point, you know, Friday going into Saturday, I thought we'd be talking about an Indians-Tigers game right now the way it was starting to shape up. If you think back to the end of Friday night, technically the Tigers had won three in a row, those two against Cleveland after they at the Indians had clinched, and you had the Thursday round. They did take the first game from Atlanta, then the wheels fell off. So
they lost the last two against, what was it, KC, before they played Cleveland.
Right.
Which, so, you know, those four losses, those two to
that's
KC
it right there.
And two to Atlanta, that's what cost them a shot at being in the playoffs.
Right? Oh, no question about it. No question about it. But I know there are guys who are in the Major League Baseball offices who are biting all their fingernails off last week on the possible chaos scenarios that are breathing sighs of relief that those don't have to happen. I'll tell
no
you
question.
That right now.
And you know what? I'm sure there's a sigh of relief from Terry Francona, too, who doesn't have to mess up his pitching now.
Absolutely.
Just to play a meaningless game for them. Well, it might not be meaningless, again, in the home field advantage story. But didn't have to play that game today either. By the way, speaking of the ALDS, game times have been announced literally just in the last few minutes.
Ooh, nice!
8:08 will be first pitch on Thursday, game one at Cleveland.
Nice.
Boston and Cleveland. an afternoon 4:38 tilt Friday in game number two. Corey Kluber will go at 4:38 Friday. And then after an off day Saturday to travel to Boston, game three will be in Boston, Fenway, 4:08 p.m. That's all they have in case, you know, because the other ones are if necessary.
Okay. All right.
So there are your game times. You can put that in your next update.
Excellent.
If you would like to do that. But on the flip side, let's go back to the Detroit Tigers and the collapse down the stretch. And really, this was team streak all season long. They had a streak in the month of May of losses that had us all on Brad Ausmus watch. And I don't remember exactly how bad it got. If it was 8 in a row, 9 in a row, or 10 in a row, whatever it was bad. And we were all on Brad Ausmus watch. Is he going to be gone? They broke that losing streak and then went on a winning streak. And then pretty much played streaky baseball the rest of the way for the next 4 months. Obviously, streaking in the wrong direction at the end, losing, what, four of their last, counting the Indians lost too. I want to say five of their last nine is where it came down, what it came down to, Jim?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that sounds about right.
When a spot in the play-in game, and by the way, I hope people don't get mad at this, but I still agree with Kenny Lofton. And I know some people don't like this, but I still agree with Kenny Lofton, who complained that the 2013 Indians didn't actually make the playoffs. People got to stop talking how they made the playoffs. All they did was make the play-in game to get into the playoffs, which really are only playoffs when you're in the division series. So, you know, he doesn't really think that the Indians had a playoff berth in 2013, and I agree with him. So when I say the wild card games are going to be played, understand it's a play-in game. The Tigers had a chance to get into the play-in game, and they laid an egg when they needed it most against Kansas City that they should have beaten, which the Indians did, of course, in their final series. You know, the Tigers lost two out of three there, and then they lost two of three in Atlanta, a last-place team, which has a very interesting question, Kush, being asked on a lot of different social media sites and, of course, on our Facebook page for ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. If you click on that page right now, you're going to see two not-so-grinning faces, two very concerned-looking faces. One belongs to Lions coach Jim Caldwell. The other one belongs to Tigers coach Brad Ausmus. And the instruction, choose only one to get fired. Choose one of the following to fire. That's the question we've got for you on our Facebook page right now. And check that out yourself at ESPN 106.5, The Ticket on Facebook. Jim Cushlin, do you have an answer to that question? And if you don't, since you're more of a Cleveland sports fan, what do you think Detroit sports fans are thinking about the answer to that question?
Well, for me, in thinking about this type of question, to me, in terms of pick one who should get fired first, basically, to me, it's Brad Ausmus. I mean, look, I know there's a lot of complaints right now from Lions people regarding Jim Caldwell and some of the mistakes this team is making and on and on and on. At the same time, I've even read some articles from some Detroit guys in the Free Press and Detroit News and what have you over the last 4 or 5 days. They're saying, you know, some of this is possibly the Lions, you know, Caldwell being set up to fail. The real clincher, though, for me is one is only a quarter away through their season. The other's season is done and finished in disappointing fashion. For a guy that you pull 10 random Tigers fans, and I bet 5 of them would have said, I still don't even know why we hired Brad Ausmus in the first place, would be something like their answer. This is 2 years in a row now that this Tigers team, with the payroll and some of the other pieces on offense and in the pitching staff, have not even been able to make the playoffs / play-in game, let alone go any farther after that. And let's put it this way. I saw somebody, a fun tweet. I'm still following him on Twitter from years ago, the quote-unquote fake Jim Leland account. Sometimes those fake accounts are hilarious. But in this case, Bob, it brought up a very interesting number. The number was, in the 22 years prior to Jim Leland becoming manager of the Tigers, they had one playoff win. That one playoff win was to avoid being swept in the 1987 ALCS. So essentially we're starting from after the 84 championship, right? Jim Leland's tenure, here I think it was 22 total playoff wins, including two pennants. Since then, zero playoff wins in one appearance, which was now 3 seasons ago in 2014 when they were swept by the Orioles in that horrible bullpen display. He's had a couple years with this roster in this window. And sometimes the moves he makes are just head-scratching. Like the last week, having Miguel Cabrera.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Rolling on, are we? It is 3:39 on this Monday afternoon edition. Monday afternoon quarterback right here on the Extravaganza. ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader. Time to talk a little more NFL. We will get into the Lions in a lot more depth coming up at about 4:05 with Chris Lemieux of PrideToDetroit.com. He's going to join us to talk about the 1-3 Lions. But now let's talk about the only winless team in the National Football League. How painful is that to say, but how expected is it or was it to be the case? That's where we are with the Cleveland Browns. Dennis Manilof joins us now, covers the Browns and more in Cleveland for the Northeast Ohio Media Group. He's also the author of an outstanding book you should read called From A to Z, Andrews to Zastadil. How you doing, Big D-Man? How are you, brother?
Thanks for having me, Bob France.
It's always our pleasure to have you. The Browns are the only winless team at the quarter pole. Four games in, that's a quarter of the season gone by. Does that surprise you?
A little bit. I mean, I was very, very, very optimistic in predicting 5-11 at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
So, and in that 5-11 prediction, I had at least one win in the first four. So yes, being winless at this point for the Browns is somewhat surprising. Although, you know, the asterisk there is you look at the roster, you look at the youth, you look at the fact that they are, you know, building, and then you say, well, what did you expect? You know, did you expect them to go into Miami and win, or did you expect them to go into Washington and win? What's really bizarre, Bob, is, you know, yes, teams can lose, but the way the Browns lose, it just continues to be almost head-scratching.
They're very creative. They're very creative. They come up with a lot of new ways to lose, don't they?
I mean, look, they come back from a 14-0 deficit yesterday against the Redskins. They have the lead deep into the third quarter.
Mm-hmm.
They're up 20-17. They've got the ball inside the 20 for the Redskins. First down. Hand off to Malcolm Johnson, their fullback. First career NFL carry. In fact, I think it was his first career carry, NFL and college. He fumbles the ball. Redskins recover at the 9, and the defense for the Browns says, well, we'll let you go 91 yards and score a touchdown to take the lead. Next possession, Browns at the 50. Duke Johnson fumbles. Over-exuberant side judge runs in and signals Redskins recovery looking into a pile where the ball is not. The ball is in the hands of Duke Johnson Jr. while the side judge is signaling Redskins ball. Redskins don't do anything with that possession. Next possession, interception. In Washington territory, Washington cashes that into a touchdown. Three possessions, three turnovers, 14 points for the Redskins, game over.
So, first of all, let's go back to the carry that you just mentioned, the first carry ever. Malcolm Johnson, you said he didn't even carry in college. I didn't hear that part.
I don't think that he carried in college either. Kush will have to check that, but I don't believe that's the case.
This reminds me, Dennis, and I'm sure you recall this, of a few years ago, and I don't remember who it was under. I want to say it was under Pat Shurmur. It might have been under Chudzinski. I just can't remember which of the myriad of coaches that the Cleveland Browns have had over the last 5 or 6 years it was. But somebody had a backup tight end in at fullback because the fullback was injured and they just needed, you know, essentially what a fullback is a guard, you know, another blocker in front of the running back. And it might have been Shurmur who called
it. I'm almost positive it was Shurmur, yeah. And
do you remember the tight end's name? I want to say Smith.
Yeah, you're right.
And they gave the ball to a tight end who had never taken a handoff before, ever.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened. A fumble happened. So it's like the regime changes, the front office changes, the quarterback changes, the coach changes, and the same old stupid stuff goes on again and again and again. It's the kind of thing you can't
run.
You couldn't make this up.
Yeah, I like Jackson, and he's, you know, but this one really caused me to go, what are you doing? Because, and I know he justifies it. All right, Malcolm Johnson's a professional. you know, at that point, Crowell was gassed because he had run the previous couple of plays or been involved in the previous couple of plays. Duke Johnson was being looked at, I guess, for a potential concussion, even though he didn't have one. So they were taking precautions with him. But still, I mean, you can rationalize it all you want, but come on. The first carry of the guy's NFL career is going to be in the red zone at Washington when you're in the lead and with a chance to go up potentially by 10 in the third quarter. I don't get it. I really don't understand. And again, Hugh Jackson, well, he's a professional. He should hold on to the ball. Well, yeah, ideally, sure. But I honestly, I'm not going to dust off Malcolm Johnson as a ball carrier in that situation.
I totally agree, and it is frustrating to hear these kinds of things. Let's talk about positives, though, in that game yesterday. Let's talk about Terrell Pryor, and let's talk about Cody Kessler, who, you know, for being a rookie who was never supposed to take a snap this year, it was going to be Robert Griffin, and if he got broken like he seems to frequently get broken, it was going to be Josh McCown. It's just not supposed to be Cody Kessler time, and for two games it has been, and he hasn't embarrassed himself out there, Dennis.
No, Kessler's been serviceable, solid. Look, listen, for 2.5 quarters, he was playing at an A level to me. I mean, I do the grade card, I do the QB report, I gave him a B minus, this time because of, you know, the pick that you just can't throw deep in your own territory, and also because they lost, and primarily because there wasn't much going on after that. I mean, he kind of fizzled late, as did his team. You know, before that, for 2.5, 2.75 quarters, he was really good. I mean, for what he can do. And that's the key thing, Bob, is when you watch Kessler, you don't see power arm. You don't see the guy who can spread the field, who can force DBs to respect the deep ball. So he has to be, he has to be precise, and he has to be, the ball's got to get out quickly, and it's got to go where it's supposed to go. And, you know, for a decent chunk of that Redskins game, he was doing it as he was in the Miami game the previous week. But the key with Kessler, at least right now, is you have to look at him with sort of a limitations contingency. I mean, you can't – he's not – I don't think his ceiling is going to be super high. And that's, you know, unfortunately the drawback.
Dennis Manilof joining us as we break down some NFL action for yesterday. Dennis covers the Browns, which means he watched the Browns every play again and again for his quarterback grade card. The loss to the Redskins 31-20 drops them to 0-4, the only winless team in the league. Another positive, two other positive spots, and then we'll move on because we've got to get a few other things in, Dennis. Isaiah Crowell continues to be one of the surprise stories in the NFL in terms of rushing leaders. Goes for 112 yesterday. He had 15 carries. The longest run was 19 yards. And I bring that up because, you know, sometimes these things are skewed when somebody says, hey, they had a 120-yard rushing day. Oh, yeah, he also had an 85-yard run. Doesn't mean he was effective on a play-to-play basis. But yesterday, in only 15 carries, he was effective on a play-to-play basis. He averaged 7.5 a carry. The running game for the Browns, and 53 for Duke Johnson. You know, you put 163 up on 28 carries, you average 5.8 yards a carry, you ought to win a football game.
Yeah, the Browns have shown so far that they're capable of hitting that sort of middle trap play, you know, up the middle. That they're not really good on anything on the edges, but they are able to run up the middle reasonably well. And Crowell's got that really good, you know, he hits the hole quickly, and, you know, he's got some strength and some speed in the open field. So, yeah, I like what I saw from Crow. It's encouraging for sure. And Duke Johnson, of course, is the quote-unquote change of pace back. Yeah, I mean, they have some pieces, parts on offense. And, you know, you and I haven't spoken since the Gordon thing blew up. But, you know, I was looking forward to that. You know, Gordon on one side, Pryor on the other. But, of course, that was wishful thinking.
So was Cody Kessler. Without, so was Josh McCown. So was Robert Griffin.
Yeah, but even without Gordon, you still have – you know, some guys to look at. And Pryor did some good things, especially in the first half yesterday. I know Josh, and he was turning Josh Norman inside out. And, of course, Norman's crowing in the second half because he, quote-unquote, shut out Pryor or all but one catch, I think it was.
Yeah.
But the reality is they didn't, you know, I don't think that it was because Norman was dominating prior. I think it was because the Redskins front did a better job of pressuring Kessler, and they knew
you
they
don't have to cover
Kessler
as long.
Had. Yeah, so, listen, but Norman, he deserves, you know, his credit for what he did in the second half. But the point is, most importantly for Browns fans, is that Pryor went up against Josh Norman, who's a highly paid, highly skilled corner, and looked very good against him in his, you know, fourth professional game as a receiver.
Dennis, you brought up Josh Gordon very briefly because I want to get your thoughts on the Indians going into the postseason here in just a moment. But since you brought up Josh Gordon, and you're right, you and I have not spoken since this all went down last week. Are you, A, nodding your head in agreement, saying, good job, Josh, way to go. You recognize you have a problem. You go take care of yourself. That's most important. This is a good decision. Or are you shaking your head side to side and going, my God, what a waste of freaking talent. You know, doggone well, he didn't realize something here. He's got another positive test. He either failed or he's got another test he has to take, and he knows he's going to fail because he's been smoking weed. What a waste. I'm done with this guy. Are you not
a little bit of
shaking your head?
A little bit of both, Bob, and I'm not trying to hedge, but it is.
That'll make you
truly
dizzy if you try to nod and shake your head at the same time.
Right, exactly. And that's what happens when you evaluate or you analyze Gordon, is you do get dizzy because you can't believe what you're seeing, what you're hearing. Listen, you can't help but be cynical, all right? And I, you know, like you say, my first thought when I heard about this was, all right, he's trying to beat the rap. You know, he's coming up with something to salvage. You know, I'm sure, well, at least I was thinking that perhaps he had contacted his agent and said, all right, how do I get out of this? Okay, but you can't help but do that because of what Josh Gordon has done in the past.
Right, his history.
However, when a guy says, I want to clean up my life and go to rehab, you also want to give him the benefit of the doubt. And so there, I think there is room for the mixed emotions analysis of Gordon in this case. I came out on a video recently and I said that the Browns need to hold on to Gordon as long as it takes. And listen, if there's any cutting that's going to happen, it's going to be by the NFL. And I think maybe you and I have disagreed on this, but my point is this. If in fact the first point you made is true, that Gordon genuinely said at that particular moment, I've got to get help. I got to get clean. Yes, he has an epiphany. If that's true, then if I'm the Browns, I want him to get clean on my watch, in my employ, okay? So go ahead, get clean, get sober, get ready to go, come back here, and be a Pro Bowl receiver, okay? If the cynical element is in play, if in fact he was trying to beat it and he's never going to get clean, okay, well, that's another matter that you're going to have to think of. But I take him at his word for now, at least publicly. And if I'm the Browns, I say, I want a payoff for this. I want to get something out of all the time that I've put into getting this guy right. The last thing I want is for him to go get clean. I cut him. He re-signs with another team. He's a new, vibrant man who's beaten all the demons. And guess what? He's dominating on the football field.
Yep, you're right, Dennis. We have disagreed on this, and I disagree again. I would release him, especially if I find out the reason for the rehab trip here is that he knows he's dirty again, and they can find that out from the league. The league will inform them if he's being suspended for another year or not suspended again. He was on the banned list. This would be another ban for a year minimum, and even then, it's not a guarantee you come back. You got to apply for reinstatement. We all know how that goes, and it probably would be harder to get a green light from Goodell the second time around after yet another ban. So for that reason, if it is indeed that reason, I would release him. And the reason why is I don't feel like he's going to come back and be a Pro Bowler for anybody, because I think he will have taken his last snap in the National Football League. I really think the guy is just going to be done if that is indeed what happened here. It's going to be too hard for him to come back.
Yeah,
he will have missed, almost three full seasons to try to come back from, which is almost unheard of, to have that much time off in between playing games, you know, at a competitive level. Go ahead, Dennis.
Yeah, that's why my point has been, let the NFL do it, okay? That's what I said. If the NFL wants to get rid of him, wants to ban him, fine. That's the deal, okay? But until the NFL drops the hammer, I would rather have him employed by the Browns than somebody else. That's all I was saying.
So briefly, in about 4 minutes we have left, Dennis, shifting gears since you're out there in Cleveland, give us the lowdown on the American League Central champions. We just got the game times. Going to be 8:38, I think it was, on Thursday, I should say, a 4:08 start on Friday, both of those at Progressive Field in Cleveland. Can a rotation of Bauer, Kluber, and Tomlin in that order take down David Ortiz's swan song celebrating Boston Red Sox in a five-gamer?
Wait, Bob, is David Ortiz retiring?
Have you heard that somewhere?
I don't know that I've heard that anywhere. Is that only a rumor, or is that actually
no,
true?
No, I think that one was confirmed late last night, actually.
Listen, it doesn't look good for the Indians, but you know what? They've defied the odds all year, and I don't know how in the world they won 94 games. You can point to numbers, of course, in certain players, but realistically, 94 wins just astonishes me. How the Detroit Tigers aren't in the playoffs astonishes me with all that firepower. But listen,
they laid down. They lost two of three to lowly Atlanta the last weekend when they had a chance to tie Baltimore or Toronto.
And I know it sounds like Indians guy kicking Tigers guy when he's down, but that's embarrassing. I mean, I would have said the same thing if I were, if it were the Indians going to Atlanta and losing the last two. I mean, come on, you can't do that.
No, hey, listen, they agree. They're not going to get mad at you. They agree. They want Ausmus fired. Most of them do. This is unacceptable to Tigers fans, believe me. And the vast majority of them have wanted Ausmus fired for a long time anyway.
Yeah. So, but regarding the Indians' chances, I mean, I don't think they're that good. I mean, it helped, obviously, that they got home field. I didn't think they were going to. They swung that thing in the last 2 days. They didn't even have to play the 162 in Detroit.
Right.
But the key is obviously, it's so obvious. In a short series, first guy up, Bauer. It's the start of his life. It's his postseason debut. He's got to deliver. If Bauer sets the tone with a good start and can somehow, hold the Red Sox down and the Indians win game one, then I will all of a sudden like their chances. But somehow I think that the Red Sox will be able to wear down Bauer, and it's not going to go necessarily too well.
Would it matter to you if Kluber hadn't strained that groin and was going in game one? And you reasonably can predict a Kluber win in game one. And now you got Bauer in two. The pressure is a little less, I think, if you already have a one-game bulge, an advantage in a five-gamer. Would it matter, or is it still the same, no matter what order they are, it is what it is?
Of course you would have preferred Kluber fully healthy, setting the tone in a game one dominant performance, or so you would hope. Yeah. So that would be the alternative. That would be the number one option, obviously. You want a Cy Young candidate going out there in game one.
Who wins in the American League wild card matchup? Is it Baltimore or Toronto?
I like Toronto. I do. And yeah, I Toronto? Think Toronto, that Toronto-Texas series is going to be fabulous.
That's what's my next question. Who do you like in that series? You like the Red Sox in the Indians-Red Sox series. Not like, obviously, in that way, but that's your prediction. Who do you like in that Texas and Toronto then?
I like Toronto to pull the upset. I don't think they care. I don't think they care about the home field in that situation. I think they can. They love to play the Rangers, and so I like Toronto to upset them.
And what exactly happens the first time Joey Batts slides into second base in the playoffs against the Texas Rangers?
Listen, if it is Toronto and Texas, I wish that series would go old school, like nine games, best of nine. I mean, I can't wait to see those two guys. They can't stand each other. There's players on each team that would just as soon hit you in the ribs and look at you. So that would be fantastic. Of course.
Will that resume? Will that brawl that resume with Odor when he belted Jose when Jose was trying to get this thing over with? And we all know how it went down. I mean, there was a suspension. I think 8 games is what Odor got. Does that continue, or do they realize, hey, we can't be messing around and getting suspended in the playoffs?
Who knows, Bob?
Because they hate each other. You're right. That'd be a great series.
Yeah. The dislike between those two teams and players on each team is severe enough that you can't convince me that they'll go a whole series without something. Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, Gibbons and Bannister are guys that eat nails for breakfast. I mean, they'll have their players grinding. I mean, it's going to be, you know, all sorts of machismo out there. But again, the whole thing could be messed up if Bucky Showalter's gang takes care of them tomorrow night, which, again, I would be kind of disappointed. To me, Toronto and Texas is must-see TV. Texas and Baltimore, not so much. I think Texas would take out Baltimore with minimal difficulty.
Last thing, Dennis, because we got to run, but now former Rockies manager Walt Weiss sat DJ LeMahieu so that he could keep the batting title instead of sending him out there to bat and giving it up potentially to Daniel Murphy. Is it a real batting title or is that just a load of crap?
I'm okay with it because the other guy was hurt. If I were Walt Weiss, I would have said, hey, LeMahieu, you want to play? And put it on him. You know, put it on LeMahieu.
I don't think it matters, Dennis, because you know what? If LeMahieu was any kind of a real batting champion or a champion of any kind or just a man, he would have said, why is my name not in the lineup, Skip? Come on, I want to play. I mean, that's what he ought to do.
Yes,
right,
sir.
That's what he ought to do. You know the Ted Williams story. You know that Ted Williams going into the final weekend of the season was hitting 400 on the button. You know that if he goes up and hits nine times, he could fall below 400. Instead, he goes 6-for-9 in the three games, for crying out loud, and ends up, or in the two games, I think it was. He goes 6-for-9 and ends up at 406. You know, that's man's game right there.
Because
asked, do you want to sit and keep the 400? And he said, are you kidding me? Come on, let's go play ball. He went 6-for-9. Come on.
But here's the thing, Bob. I'll say this, and I hear you. I would more so be inclined, usually I'm inclined to go your direction.
Yeah.
But I've been in enough clubhouses. I could honestly say, my gut tells me, if you went into that Colorado clubhouse and you asked all of his teammates, privately, not to be made public, which would you do? What do you think? I bet you get a split. I really do. I bet you half of the guys would say, go ahead, protect it. We like Walt Weiss for protecting us and getting us the title, making sure we get the title. And the other half would say, I really wish that, you know, he would have said, no, I want in.
Bush League. So, it's Bush League, man. Let me ask you, who would be the Indian most likely to contend for a batting title? Probably Lindor?
Maybe
Kip?
Jose Ramirez.
Maybe Ramirez? If you went up to Jose Ramirez and he was leading by 2 percentage points in the final weekend, would you, and you gave him a choice, what do you think Kip would say? Kip, you want to sit right now and protect that thing? Or do you want to go bat? What do you think he would do?
Kip was like, you'll have to chain me to the bat rack
before I don't go out there.
And, you make a point.
The other thing, Dennis, too, and this is just one of these things that chafes me, is it's Colorado. You know, he's hitting 303 away from Coors. He's hitting 393 or whatever it is at Coors. It's a manufactured batting title anyway in Colorado, the way I think 8 Rockies batting title holders have been since that place was built. It is just a joke. It's a different sport there with a different atmosphere, literally a physical atmosphere. To me, it is a crap batting title anyway, and then for them to have him sit to protect it, it's even worse. Walt Weiss, I'm glad he got canned today. He's gone, and he should be gone.
A crap batting title.
It is. It's garbage. It's like every batting title that comes out of Colorado. Yeah, they've had 8 in the last 25 years or however long it's been since Coors was built. 8 batting titles. Do you think that's coincidence? It's not coincidence. It's atmospheric pressure. What a load of garbage.
Bob, I'll leave you with this. I still can't believe the Tigers didn't make the playoffs.
D-Man, I love you, brother. Thanks for the call. We were so late. Let me tell you about the Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro Superstore, because you need to get out there and support your Buckeyes or your undefeated Wolverines or your struggling Fighting Irish, the Spartans, the Rockets, the Falcons, the Tigers, all of it available at the Buckeye Store and More. Hundreds of new Nike products are in stock. Save 10% store-wide and save 50 to 75% on doorbuster items if you get there early each and every day. That's right. At the Buckeye Store and More, it's the largest store in Ohio dedicated to Buckeyes. Buckeye gear. The Buckeye Store and More is in Sylvania at Starlight Plaza, 5700 Monroe. You can't miss it, right between Ralphie's and Dave's and in front of Prometica in Sylvania at the Buckeye Store and More, the College and Pro Superstore. Talking Lions and Tigers and Wolverines with Chris Lemieux coming up next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Obviously, not the outcome we wanted. We had our chances. Can't turn the ball over the last three series. I think our guys continue to fight. We got down 14. I think nobody on the sideline blinked. We were able to catch them again after halftime. I gotta solve that riddle after halftime. Obviously, it was the turnovers today. And again, I take responsibility for it all. Players got to get better. They know that. I got to coach them better. But at the same time, I think the guys are trying as hard as they can.
How do I characterize the results? They were poor. You got to give credit to Chicago. They did all the things that we really wanted to do in this ball game. They did it to us. They ran the ball better than we did. They didn't turn the ball over. You know, they made a lot of gritty, tough plays, and they wouldn't perform well. It was just penalties and miscommunication, and you know, there was something about every other drive that kind of stalled you. You were starting from back a little bit further than you'd like in certain situations, talking about putting yourself back with a holding penalty or a false start or something. And we just were not sharp at all. I mean, there was no rhythm to it. You know, that's my fault. I got to get these guys in a better rhythm, and we gotta play better. We didn't play well.
The 41st edition of golf's premier team event, the Ryder Cup. The minds of fans at Hazeltine National Golf Club and the golf world at large were still fastened to the memory of a singular legend.
Arnold Palmer! Arnold Palmer!
The host Americans shot out of the gates on Friday morning. Led by youngsters Patrick Reed and Jordan Spieth, the morning foursomes were dominated by the U.S. team, who claimed their first opening session sweep since, coincidentally, Palmer was captain back in 1975.
It has been a remarkable opening session for the United States.
Europe dominated the afternoon, winning three of four matches. Just 5 points. That's all that separated the U.S. team from their first Ryder Cup win since 2008 at the start of play on Sunday. The U.S. team was not to be denied. Fowler, Snedeker, Brooks Koepka, all holding their nerve to win their matches, pushing the United States across the finish line. It was Ryan Moore finally doing the honors with the clinching point.
You know, friends, so many people have wished me congratulations on a 67-year career in baseball, and they wished me a wonderful retirement with my family. And now, all I can do is tell you what I wish for you. May God give you for every storm a rainbow, for every tear a smile, for every care a promise, and a blessing in each trial. For every problem life seemed a faithful friend to share, for every sigh a sweet song, and an answer for each prayer. You and I have been friends for a long time, but I know in my heart that I've always needed you more than you've ever needed me. And I'll miss our time together more than I can say. But you know what? There will be a new day and eventually a new year. And when the upcoming winter gives way to spring, oh, rest assured, once again, it will be time for Dodger baseball. So this is Vin Scully wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon wherever you may be.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
And what an extravaganza we've had so far today. We still have 45 minutes of it coming your way. Really, really outstanding, powerful stuff there in the montage. The great Vin Scully signing off after 67 years as the golden voice of baseball. And I know Tigers fans worldwide love Ernie Harwell, and with good reason, one of the greatest voices of the grand game ever. But I think worldwide, Vin Scully just transcends anything and everybody. Marty Brenneman, I mean, there have just been so many great voices. But when you heard Vin speak, you just felt like you were hearing the voice of a baseball god. And he called it a career after 67 years. He's now 88 years old, still looks and sounds great. Then, of course, the Ryder Cup, the Americans shocking everybody by taking down the Europeans in a rare Ryder Cup win. And just the display of genuine emotion that you heard from the fans there, the American fans, I mean, it was wonderful, a thing to behold. I watched it. In fact, I've got it loaded up on my Facebook page. It's my private Facebook page, so everybody can't see it, but you've probably already seen it. It went viral as the Gallery of Americans just spontaneously broke out into song. What were they singing? Well, I'll give you one guess. All right, I can't hear it. Why can't I hear it? It looks like everything's a go. Oh, now I see where the problem lies. One second. Here's what they were singing. I can say is, hey, Colin Kaepernick and Megan Rapinoe and the rest of you punk anti-American losers, protest this. That's what I've got for you. Now back to Monday afternoon quarterback right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. The Browns are still the only winless team in football. The Lions might be the worst team in football. Well, there's a whole lot of 1-3 teams, but let's see what Chris Lemieux thinks about that. The Lions fell to the Brian Hoyer-led Chicago Bears yesterday. 17-14 was the final. Three straight losses now for the Lions, and the seat under Mr. Caldwell has just gotten hotter. Chris Lemieux from PrideOfDetroit.com. Good to have you back, brother. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing all right here. Just one of those anti-Americans out there, I guess. But hey, you know,
Are you kneeling during that anthem?
I'm not even standing, but this is a long story and probably a story we are not going to get through if we want to talk about Lions football here.
No, it's not. And based on what you're saying right now, it's probably one I don't want to know about because that.
No, I know your political allegiance here. I know we are very, very opposite people. But I mean, as you say, you want to talk about the sports, not
absolutely.
The politics.
Absolutely, and that's exactly why I wish the rest of these athletes would just take their other crap to another forum.
Oh, I mean, I'd like to
be sports. So.
Well, I mean, from my side, I'd like to stop seeing the military in our sports, too. That's technically politics. But again, we're getting down this road. Are we going to talk? We should probably talk Alliance here.
Well, let's get into the question that I just asked a moment ago. And you
sure.
Look at the standings right now of all of the 1-3 teams. And I'm just going to evict mm-hmm. the Cleveland Browns from the conversation because they're 0-4. The Jets, the Dolphins. The Jaguars, the Titans, the Colts, the Chargers, the Bears, the Lions, Bucks, Panthers, Saints, Niners, and Cardinals. That's a mouthful, I know.
Mm.
Those are all the 1-3 teams in the National Football League. Based on what you've seen, not just in their 1-3 records, but performance, progress, talent, momentum, all of the above, where do you rank the Lions in that crew of bottom dwellers? I could make a case that I would say dead last, above really only the 0-4 Browns.
Yeah, I mean, man, I'm looking in there because, as you say, there's a lot of good company in there, and this Lions team's been regressing, like just going down pretty hard. Like, you lost to the Bears.
Yep.
You lost to the Bears. You lost to the Bears. You lost to the Brian Hoyer Bears. I think we called this chicken soup before the end of it. You choked on the bone. So this is a problem. And it's a really big problem because it's not only that the defense just got manhandled in every way possible by, again, Brian Hoyer, but, I mean, Eddie Royal had a 100-yard gain for the first time in about, what, I want to say 4 years? So there was that to contend with. Zach Miller went off, which, I mean, you kind of expect that. The Lions been having trouble with Titans. But then the offense just isn't doing that well either. I'd put them maybe above the Jaguars, but that's probably about it. Like, there's not many
contend Jaguars, here. The Jaguars looked pretty good in London at 9:30 in the morning yesterday against the Indianapolis
there's
Colts.
That's the Eldritch power of London, though. I don't trust results from London, just as I don't trust results from Thursday night football. Just the juju gets off whenever we start playing these football games at non-normative hours. Just everything seems to go out of whack. Like, oh man, I was watching, I mean, I can't remember how many times I've watched the Jaguars, like, just completely bomb through a game in London. It just those games have weird juju to them. So
yeah
maybe.
I get your point.
They'd be tied. They'd be tied, I would think, with the Jaguars. Let's go with that.
I get your point on that. I might also throw the Niners in there. The Niners, despite beating up on the Rams in Week One, you know, as the Rams were just, you know, coming back, I guess, whatever you want to call it, you know, the whole thing, the LA and everything else, they've been awful. They have been awful the last few weeks. They have regressed. When you talk about the Lions, I think there's a lot of similarities there. The Lions, of course, put up that 39 on Indianapolis and showed some good things, and then have regressed for three straight weeks. I think the same could be said of the Niners.
I think the difference lies in just looking at San Francisco about who they've played. You know, those losses to the Panthers, Seahawks, Cowboys, whereas the Lions have lost the Titans, the Bears, and who was in between? I just was looking at that, so I've completely forgot where our third loss. Oh, the Packers. So, like, yeah, the Packers lost, fine. Okay, understood. Bears lost, not understood. Titans lost, definitely not understood. This is where the plot gets lost. And it's not even that, but you look at those Titans and Bears games, too. It's like, these are the two games where the offense just doesn't get rolling. Like, and it's not for lack of trying, too. Like, they finally got some stuff together and, like, started to roll down the field, but that up-tempo just wasn't there. And then Stafford made a mistake late in the game. And then Golden Tate got benched because he was just so off. Like, he ran the completely wrong route, which led to the interception that should have been points at the end of the half. And then he just was bad the rest of the day.
He even admitted that after the game, too. He owned that and said I mean, it was on him, and it cost his team 3 points. And mentally, he doesn't know why he was that way, why he, you know, he wasn't focused on the route. He said he missed a signal. Whatever that is, and we all know how things can go at the line of scrimmage. If it was something that was changed at the line, I guess those kind of things can happen. But when you're talking about a team that's struggling as much as they are, and when every possession and every opportunity to score, even if it's a field goal, is crucial, those mental mistakes, they just cannot happen, and they're happening far too often under Jim Caldwell, which, of course, is a fancy way of transitioning to, he a quarter into the season. You know, when there was a question as to whether or not Bob Quinn would keep him anyway, coming in after last season, a quarter of the way in, is he on that hot seat?
Definitely. I think he's on the hot seat. I think he was on the hot seat to end the season. And I thought this year was kind of just, I don't know if, like, I don't know what the strangest thing about Jim Caldwell is figuring out what happened at the end of the 2015 season that precipitated him coming back, because all signs and all conventional wisdom pointed to that he should probably be out in Detroit. You know, new general manager, coming off a bad season. He wasn't the first choice to be the head coach to begin with. And somehow he sticks around and he rides this through. And, you know, to his credit, he puts in Jim Bob Cooter. But I don't know how long this can continue. Like, yeah, finding Jim Bob Cooter was kind of a little bit of a diamond in the rough. But I've kind of argued that, I mean, maybe there's a lot of other guys coming out of college now who really know these up-tempo systems. Terrell Austin's defense has just looked very shoddy. And just the way it's going is like, okay, so the main thing to hold him around was basically the staff he had built. And we're kind of seeing them just not do that well. So I don't really know what the point is. And again, Quinn's going to want to put his stamp on this sooner rather than later. I don't think it's going to be a mid-season firing. I think Caldwell, to the chagrin of some fans out there who flooded our Twitter and flooded our Facebook, fire him now, get rid of him, throw the bum out, that's not going to happen mid-season, because there is literally no one to replace him. There's no one to replace him mid-season among this staff. We've gone down the Rolodex, and like your main option is Terrell Austin. Again, Terrell Austin's defense is like dead last in the NFL right now.
Does a move, though, in mid-season, if you're going to fire somebody, is it necessarily about finding the right guy to take over in that time, like you're talking about right now? Or is it more just to placate the fans, to say, we recognize it, we hear you, we see it ourselves, it's awful, we're going to make an interim change here, we'll find you the right coach in the offseason?
I mean, it would be probably the only logic in my mind is to basically placate the fans. Like, there's no reason to fire your coach this early and then without a clear replacement. Because if you're firing him at this point in the season, it's not to get a jump on a coaching search. It's to hope that his replacement's going to right the ship. And no one in Alan Parker right now is going to right that ship other than Jim Caldwell, and I don't think he'll be able to. An argument's been put forward that you want Caldwell to pull off a Les Miles and somehow salvage this, like Les Miles did in 2015 down in LSU. And, I mean, we saw how that turned out for him this year. The Ed Orgeron years are on in the Bayou, but like I don't
singular.
Buy that.
I think you should go singular there.
Singular. I'm still hoping Ed Orgeron gets a head coaching gig somewhere. I think USC did the wrong thing getting rid of him, but we're off on a tangent there. I don't buy into that because it's just I feel like no matter what, just Caldwell's probably going to be out at the end of the year. Maybe midseason if you're talking like week 12, we'll want to get a jump start on the coaching search, but other than that, like,
so then
no,
what changes,
not.
Chris? We're talking to Chris Lemieux of PrideofDetroit.com, talking Lions, and we'll get into Michigan a little bit here, too, on a higher note, by the way. The undefeated Wolverines getting their mm-hmm. a win in their first big test, really a top-10 battle on Saturday. So if they're going to ride him then until, let's say, week 12, you know, that's another eight from now. I mean, week after week after week after poor performances, I mean, let's just look at the schedule. Philadelphia, a very surprising undefeated mm-hmm. team right now. I might have said 5 weeks ago, that's a win because Carson Wentz is going to be the starter. They are just not ready for prime time, but they kind of are.
Not only undefeated, but Jim Schwartz, former Lions head coach, as defensive coordinator, just looking against chops.
Yeah, I would imagine that's true. I would imagine that is true. Then Rams, again, who started out awfully and have turned around and righted their ship. Redskins mm-hmm. just got their second straight win. So, I mean, none of these are world beaters. Houston without J.J. Watt, they're 3-1 now, but I don't know what they'll be on October 30th. Minnesota's undefeated now, but who knows. Jacksonville, Minnesota, again. New
the
Orleans.
Around week
it's
10.
It's not a tough schedule. They don't have Denver and Pittsburgh and New England and all the, you know, the best teams in the league all over this schedule. It's not that bad.
Well, I think Minnesota's better than I think most people give them credit for, but yeah, there's not like, if you're going to, I mean, there's probably going to be a situation kind of like how we had midway through last season that he might get some wins and get it back. But going back to placating the fans for a second, again, like the placating the fans thing, that's what they did last year with the front office, other than just general exhaustion with the Martin Mayhew, Matt Millen regime. Like that was ostensibly to keep people around. So like, You're back here 1 year later, and that placating move did nothing. People are just as angry, if not angrier. So what's the point? Like, this isn't European. We're having this kind of conversation right now in Pride of Detroit. It's not European football, soccer. The fans don't have a powerful control over these multi-billion franchises. They just don't have that kind of a control when it comes to the revenue of this team, which is already near dead last when it comes to NFL revenue. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, maybe he's ousted in week 10 on the bye. But other than that, like, I think he survives the end of the season. And, yeah, he'll probably get some wins. He'll probably right the ship a little bit. I think probably they're sailing to a losing record, though. I think I pegged them at 6-10 before the season. And I think I'm looking pretty good on that right now.
I mean, I don't think they're a 6-10 team, but I think they very well could win six games because of the schedule I just ran down. It is not a murderer's row. It is a very, very favorable schedule. If anybody can really have one, you still have the division games, obviously, because they are there, and that means Green Bay twice and Minnesota. I agree with you, by the way. Minnesota's better than people think. Not too many teams could be 3-0 with Sean Hill and then Sam Bradford knowing maybe two-thirds of the playbook, winning those three games. Adrian Peterson out as well as Bridgewater. They are much better, but outside of the division, they just don't have a lot of real strong, you know, tests, I think, in that schedule.
Sure.
So they certainly could end up winning six games.
I just scared that defense.
Minnesota, you mean?
Yeah, I'm just scared to death of Minnesota's defense.
Yes.
It's really good.
With good reason. And by the way, nobody is scared of the Detroit defense. Nobody.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And injuries have, like, made it so that it shouldn't even be a sniffle there. Like, just everything top to bottom outside of Darius Slay at one of the corners. There's no one right now who's a threat. Kerry Hyder comes in and gets sacks, but he is not contributing on a macro level. Like, no one is scared of this defense. And I don't know where it is in Football Outsiders DVOA. They'll do the calculations tomorrow after Monday Night Football. I'm expecting near dead last.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Okay, let's shift gears real quick, because obviously as Pride of Detroit, you're primarily focused on Detroit, not necessarily mm-hmm. Ann Arbor, but it's close enough. So let's do this thing. The Wolverines and the Badgers, number 4 versus number 8. Not a lot of offensive fireworks in a 14-7 Michigan win, but it was the first real big test for Harbaugh's Wolverines, you know, against a top 10 team. Even though Wisconsin might have been a little bit overrated in that regard, their pounding of Michigan State, you know, certainly was a big statement game there. But 14-7, the Michigan defense answered the call and held that Wisconsin Badger offense down. What were your thoughts on the Wolverines? And is that number 4 still justified in your eyes in the current rankings?
Oh, man, I still haven't even digested all the rankings. I do some college football stuff on the side, aside from Pride of Detroit. So figuring out where Michigan's been has been kind of fascinating. On one hand, Wisconsin held them to under 45 points. First one to do it this season. Granted, they played like Colorado and Penn State. But looking at the rest of their schedule, like, man, Michigan State just lost in overtime to Indiana. Who's giving the Wolverines trouble until they hit the game at the end of the year? Like, it's not going to be Rutgers. It's not going to be Illinois. It's definitely not going to be Iowa. Probably not Indiana. I don't know if the 4 is completely justified, because it's like, okay, I haven't really... But at the same time, so you talk about not a lot of defense in that game, but Wilton Spate still threw for over 200 yards. And, like, that defense, I mean, that offense was still thrumming under the gun. It's just a matter of that they were up against Wisconsin's defense, which I think is just fantastic. But, I mean, it's not like Michigan held them, too. Like, Michigan's got a pretty good defense. That Jordan... what was his last name? Jordan Lewis, the one who caught the one-hand interception.
Oh my God, that was an Odell on defense. That was an Odell Beckham catch on defense.
That was fantastic. But even before that, I've been hearing this kid's name get called multiple times. He is just a tackling and sack making machine, and he's very good. And like, they've got a good defense. They are very well rounded, and I think, you know, it'll probably be where was Ohio State in the AP rankings? I haven't seen
number
those
two.
Yet.
Number two. Still
number two. Number two. Wow.
Well, they've been
over
there for
Clemson.
About 3 or 4 weeks now.
Oh, really? Okay. I thought Clemson would have been higher, but I guess
it
was wrong.
Clemson, before the win against Louisville on Saturday night, they had some very unimpressive victories.
That's true.
They had a comeback
true.
Victory, and I don't remember exactly who it was or what it was. Cush, you can tell me if you do. But they had some unimpressive victories, so they kind of slid from number 2 overall, which is where they started, down to about number 5 when they played Louisville the other night. Louisville, of course, had risen to 3.
Yeah, I remember that now. I was just kind of hazy on that, and that was a fantastic game. Two just really good games in college football this weekend, and Washington, of course, dominated Stanford. I think what's going to happen is just Ohio State and Michigan are going to circle each other until the end of the year. They're just, you know, just chomping at the bit. And this game is going to determine a lot of things when it comes down to it. I think actually what's going to be funny to me is, because I'm looking at some of the other conferences out there, the Big 12 is looking like it's going to have a circle of just burning itself out again this season. I don't know who's coming out of the Big 12. And I don't know who's going to come out of the Pac-12. I don't know if Washington's going to stay undefeated. So maybe Ohio State and Michigan face off once, and then maybe somehow both of them get into the playoffs. They could just be
Because whoever loses that game, even if they were both undefeated coming in, and I was listening to an interesting conversation about that this morning, and I agreed with it. It was on Mike and Mike that the loser, even if the loser loses a close game, let's say it's a 1-point game, let's say it's 24-23 heartbreaker, and both teams, and the loser has one loss now. Well, guess what? Louisville has one loss too, but their loss was a close game on the road at Clemson, all the way back at the beginning of October, and they're going to have 8 more weeks to impress the committee and watch how they've risen since that loss. The loser of Michigan-Ohio State has no time to impress the committee and erase the memory of that one loss, because it happens when it does. It's unfortunate. It's a crappy system, but that's how it is.
That's true, and if you're also a conspiracy theory, you've got to look at the SEC and wonder if they have a one-loss team at the end of the year, not named Alabama, or if Alabama for some reason like doesn't win the SEC, like if they lose to Tennessee in Atlanta or something, they'll get a second crack at it, because they're SEC or whatever the ESPN conspiracy theory of the week is among college football fans. But I think that's right. But I think it'll make for a really exciting game. This could be the biggest Michigan-Ohio State game in a long time. But again,
Two things don't get in the way of that, and both of them involve the Spartans, of course, because Ohio State has Michigan State and Michigan back-to-back, 11-19, November 19th for Michigan State. Then they've got Michigan in the finale, and then, of course, Michigan and Michigan State as early as the week before. No, I take that back. It's 2 weeks before that. They played on 10-29. So you know, Michigan State, it's still, you know, the X factor in all of these things. It's a huge rivalry with Michigan, as we all know. And little brother has taken down big brother often enough in the past few years for that still to be a big concern for the Wolverines. And they've also taken down Ohio State and been, you know, as dominant as Ohio State has been in the conference over the last 3 or 4 years.
That's true. Sparty will play spoiler, but at the same time, too, just going on conventional wisdom, barring a blocked punt return for a touchdown, like Michigan nearly won that game last year. And looking at the Spartans this year, two straight losses, including a loss they should never have had to Indiana. Like, I'm not sure I fear the Spartans as much this year. But those are famous last words, I understand.
Well, yeah, completely. And I agree with you. You're right. Based on the two losses in a row to Wisconsin and Indiana, but it's because of the rivalry, and you know that.
Sure, absolutely.
I hate sports cliches when you hear you throw the records out when these two rivals get together. But there is something to it. When Michigan State plays Michigan, it really doesn't matter if one is 6-0 and one is 0-6 when they get together. It really is one of those throw it out garbage cliches because, you know, it's just that hate filled, and it's just that, you know, those games can really, really be tight.
Another cliche for you there. Michigan State will come into that game playing like they've got nothing else to lose. It's the only thing they're playing for is to beat their rivals.
That is exactly right, and to ruin and wreck their season. And again, Michigan and State and Ohio State, while not the same rivalry, obviously, as Michigan and Michigan State or Michigan and Ohio State, just for conference supremacy in the last few years, that is still something that's very, very large as well. So
yeah, and Michigan State, Michigan is very big for both sides too. Like, I remember Spencer Hall, editorial director for SB Nation. He loves the Michigan State Michigan rivalry because these two just don't refer to each other by their proper names. Like, they barely even deign to speak each other's name. And Michigan State is the eternal little brother with a chip on the shoulder that hates when you call him the little brother and will just get so fired up. Yeah, I'm ready for Michigan State, Michigan. I'm ready for that home stretch in the Big Ten schedule. It's
going to
be fantastic.
Well, you only got 4 weeks to wait. It is four because they go on October 29th, as I said. Michigan has Rutgers, Illinois, and I'm sure Rutgers, then a bye, then Illinois, then the Michigan State game. So technically that is four Saturdays away. So we'll look forward to that too. Chris, thanks so much for the time. We appreciate the breakdown of the Lions and a little bit on the Wolverines as well. We always like to check in with prideofdetroit.com.
All right. Take care, Bob.
Thank you, Chris. There he is, Chris Lemieux from prideofdetroit.com right here on ESPN 106.5. The ticket, let me remind you, since we're talking about all this fun college sports type thing, a couple of things. Number one, you got a chance to go to the 2017 College Football National Championship game. Will the Buckeyes be in it for the second time in 3 years? Will Jim Harbaugh burst through and be there? No, I know. I can tell you this. Michigan State and Notre Dame, they won't be there. It's in Tampa in January. Info and on qualifying is coming soon from Toledo Sports Leader, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. And while we're here, let's also talk about the Ohio State Buckeyes and the Michigan Wolverines, both of whom you can find represented very, very big at the Buckeye Store and More, the college and pro superstore. It is indeed scarlet and gray from wall to wall and sea to shining sea in the Buckeye Store and More, except for the fan zones that you find inside. And that will be a huge maize and blues zone for the Wolverines, a big Fighting Irish zone for Notre Dame fans. Spartans, Rockets, Falcons, and Tigers all represented there as well at the Buckeye Store and More. But make no mistake, it is Buckeyes first and foremost. And if you are a Scarlet and Gray fan, get there. Everything in the store, and every zone too, is 10% off right now. 50 to 75% off of doorbuster items, select items each and every day in the mornings. Hundreds of new Nike products in stock. So if you want to wear your team's colors, or if you want to decorate your home in those colors, or whatever it is you need, you're going to find it at the Buckeye Store and More. Starlight Plaza, 5700 Monroe Street in Sylvania. Big Brutus is on the roof waving you in. The Buckeye Store and More, the college and pro superstore. More coming up after this. Mr. Christian, we got an appropriate song playing there right now. Waiting so long. I don't know if you could hear me trying to tell you. We got microphone issues here. We got a stuck button on a board there that just would not work.
This song is incredibly appropriate by accident.
I'm sitting there trying to talk, and then I realize it's not working. I'm not going out over the air. And I'm hearing not Eric Clapton, Eddie Money, waiting so long. Sorry. Didn't mean to make you wait so long, but it certainly was appropriate. All right, good stuff from Chris Lemieux there, and also from Dennis Mandeloff on the NFL stories of the day, and a little bit on the college football as well. Kushlin, did you watch the Toledo game Friday night?
Yeah, actually I did, because, you know, I'm getting back from Michigan calling my own high school game. I'm still wide awake at 11 o'clock, so I'm like, oh yeah, that's right, UT's out. Let me flip that over.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, that was one of the best games you're going to see in a long time, and that was one of the most heartbreaking defeats, too. And I want to give a little bit of love here. I'm sorry?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I honestly, Bob, I can't wait to talk to Coach Candle, get his thoughts on that game here in a couple days when we sit down with him on our usual, I believe,
that'll
Wednesday.
That'll be on Wednesday, I think, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, hearts break for Jason Candle and for the Toledo Rockets, because it's not just the loss, but it's not just the fact that it was the last second loss.
Yeah.
Those happen. That's college football.
Sure.
That's big time. That happens. But it's the courage that it took to get that lead before that you just can't say enough about. When you think about the fact that when Toledo tied the football game, when they scored a touchdown with, what was it, under a minute left, in order to bring the game to 52-51, and you kick a field goal, you tied at 52, and you're going into overtime, probably, and that's a safe play, probably,
right?
Because, you know, everybody
goes
to the overtime rules.
There was a minute 14 left in that game when that touchdown happened.
I'm sorry, say
that? And it was a minute 14 left in the game.
1:14. I thought it was just under a minute. It was just over a minute. Okay.
Close enough, indeed.
And when you look at what happened, they decide to go for two. They roll the dice and say, you know what, screw this overtime thing. We're going for two right now. We're going for the win here with 1:14 left. And they get it. And they get the two-point conversion to go up 53-52. And you're just thinking, my God, the guts of that. On the road at BYU, that's just an absolutely incredibly gutsy call and an incredible job of execution by the Rockets for getting it done. And by the way, Logan Woodside and a lot of guys had outstanding games, but Logan Woodside with a school record 505 yards passing in that football game, just, you know, a remarkable effort. But when they made that two-point conversion, you just think, now that's what it's all about. Now you just got to get a stop. You just got to get one stop. And you know BYU is going to come down and they're going to have an opportunity. And they did, obviously, to lose on a field goal with zeros on the clock after you went for two and showed the guts that it took to, you know, to put that game away, or to try to put that game away right then and there with a two-point conversion. To me, it's just a heartbreaking loss for the Toledo Rockets. I cannot say enough about it.
Yeah, and this game was so crazy. I mean, we're understandably fixated at what would have happened at the equivalent of 1 a.m. at the very end of this game. But, it could have been very easy for the Rockets to just, you know, mentally throw in the towel. First play from scrimmage and BYU gets a 75-yard touchdown. Rockets tie it. They give up two more touchdowns, and suddenly with a minute to go in the first quarter, it's 21-7 on the road, even though they came in 1-3 against a solid opponent in their building in BYU. To the Rockets' credit, especially offensively, Logan Woodside and Hunt and the rest of these guys fought back. They had a lead.
505 yards passing, five touchdowns for Woodside.
I believe
Kareem Hunt had 100 in
$146 in a touchdown.
I was going to say $147, but okay, 146 in a touchdown. I mean, the problem, of course, for Toledo is they couldn't stop Jamal Williams.
Yes,
you know, the BYU running back who ran for 286. I mean, a Kareem Hunt like number, 286. And five touchdowns on the ground. They just could not stop him. Eight lead changes in the second half of that game. Kush, just heartbreaking for Jason Candle and the boys.
Absolutely. And I know Jason Candle, when I've spoken to him so far this season, he mentioned that every week that goes by, his defense wants to get a little more props, because everybody knows how solid and devastating the Toledo offense can be with the passing game and the running game combined. They are so good, as we saw Friday night. But honestly, Bob, back on Friday, I had picked the Rockets to win this game. And you know why I did it? Because coming into that game on Friday, the Rockets were, and I caught this stat and I thought, that's interesting. Prior to Friday's game at BYU, the Rockets were the only team in the nation to claim they had a top 10 total offense, number 6, and a top 10 total defense. They were number 7 giving up 10.5 points a game.
What a great catch. I did not know that.
And that's why, honestly, that's why I picked Toledo to win this game. I thought their defense would come through just enough to propel that offense to do what it does best, and well, we almost had that happen, even though the defense gave up that many points.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you look at the 3-0 start that they had, Arkansas State, Maine, and Fresno State. You know, there is a potential for a lot of offense in some of those clubs, but not very much,
exactly.
Obviously. And they had not been tested on the ground, and that's where most of that damage was done, as we talked about, was on the ground. Whereas for Toledo, most of it was done with Woodside and the receiving core. It was not so much that way for BYU, I mean. I'm looking at BG now. That's why I got confused there. BG, of course, lost their third straight in 4 out of 5, 28-25 to Eastern Michigan. We'll talk to Mike Jinks tomorrow about that. Progress. I guess that's all you're looking for in your first year with BG is progress. 77-3 to Memphis, obviously, a week earlier. You lose a close one, 28-25. Your team is much more competitive and in it, and had an opportunity. So you look for progress. You find it wherever you can. Ohio State, again, with no problem, as expected, 58-0 over Rutgers. They'll take on Indiana, coming off a big win over Michigan State coming up this week as well. Shifting to baseball before Dunk Cushion, I don't know when you're going to fire that music bed, but you heard Dennis Manilow and I had a little disagreement on the National League batting title. Real quick, do you agree with DJ LeMahieu sitting out the last couple of games so that he didn't lose the batting title to Daniel Murphy of the Nats? 348 for LeMahieu, 347 for Murphy. But Murphy's batting average didn't change the last three weeks because he's sitting out with an injury. He's not dodging ABs to lower because he's afraid of lowering his average.
Right.
He's injured. So Walt Weiss sits LeMahieu.
And what turned out to be his final game, by the way, Walt Weiss was fired today.
That's right. That's right, which I kind of cheered about when I mentioned that to Manilow. But LeMahieu sat out in his last couple for that reason, just to win the batting title.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't put up a 1-for-3 even would knock him down under the 348 mark. And so he is now the batting champion after not going out there and actively defending it when he was healthy enough to do so. Are you okay with that move by Weiss?
No, I am not okay. And I cite to you, I love doing this every now and again, something else that came up in the baseball series. Back in 1941, the famed Ted Williams hitting 400 year, Red Sox manager for that whole last weekend kept saying, you want us to sit down so you can protect your 400 average. And Ted Williams is like, no, that's stupid. Why would I do that? And I kind of remember
Williams
that principle ever since
more
then.
I bet you Ted Williams.
I'm probably cleaning it up
more,
a little.
but I mean, I'm sure it wasn't like a why would I do that? It was probably more of a do you want me to smack you in the mouth right now?
And
he was probably incredibly insulted by the suggestion.
Yeah, and he was back in the day when that happened. Now, sure, that was for batting 400, and this is just the yearly batting title, but I feel the same principle holds. You have to defend it.
I do too. And he's like, why would I sit out 2 baseball games just to keep 400? I mean, I'm here to play. That's what I'm paid to do.
The Red Sox manager in 41 offered it to him for the entire final weekend back in 41 to protect his record.
And all he does is go 6-for-9.
In the final doubleheader, yep.
And jacks it up to 406, the last time anybody has eclipsed that magical mark in a single season. Wow. Yeah, really, really a sad story for me. Because to me, and as I mentioned to him, anything that happens in Rockies Coors Park or Coors Field, to me is, and I don't even know they call it that anymore. It's
still Coors Field.
But anything that happens there to me is taken with a grain of salt anyway, because those guys have such an unfair advantage. All right, that's it. All the time we got. Glad Walt Weiss got fired. I don't mean to rain on anybody's parade, but you know what? That's just the way that is. Thanks for being a part of the show. Thanks to Dennis Manilow, Chris Lemieux for being the guest today. Thanks to you for listening to it. Thanks to Jim Cushman for producing it. And we'll talk to you tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock for the next extravaganza. Stay where you are. Drive time coming up.